Hello, Barely Legal Comedy Podcast listeners. I'm Alex Boardman.
I'm Chris Keogh.
Yes, you are.
I am.
And as you will have noticed, this is not a Greg's special because I've got not enough time to do it and we can't make our schedules work. Unfortunately, this is the only day we've got, and a Greg special is a full day experience. So that is coming. So apologies to everyone thinking this would be a Greg's based episode, but it's not. However,
no.
It's a very relevant episode because if you've been watching Channel 4's The Jury, it's based around that. We've had a listener question. So to Barely Legal Comedy Podcast, which is our Twitter X handle, we had at Barely Legal Pod from John Wyatt, or at Johnny Wi-Fi. Are you doing on Channel 4's The Jury? So I'd imagine, are you doing an episode on Channel 4's The Jury?
I think it's probably one on, I guess.
Are you doing one on Channel 4's The Jury? I'd like to know what the psychiatric / psychological basis is for the loss of control defence. That's a very good, very specific question, and it's kind of what we've been looking at weeks and weeks ago in general defences to murder, isn't it?
So
thank you for that, Johnny Wi-Fi. So firstly, I've been away, so I don't really know what Channel 4's The Jury is. So what is that roughly? Do you know?
Yeah, so I've not seen it, but I saw lots of coverage of it, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So like newspaper reports and people on Twitter and Facebook and all that, and sort of like talking about it. And it appears to be, I think it's a 4-part series where there is a murder trial played out. So it's apparently it's a real life murder trial.
An actual trial like in America.
So it's a trial that,
right.
No. So it's a reenactment of a real trial. So it's a trial that did take place a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm aware, the sort of trial itself is reenacted verbatim for the purposes of the TV show.
Right. Okay.
And there are two juries, so two different juries in isolation of each other, not realizing that there is another jury. Listening to it, and we get to be a fly on the wall in their deliberations. And that's, so it's sort of like, it's a reality TV show / sort of social experiment, I guess, to sort of see, because obviously within, in real life juries, you can't get to see your jury deliberations, so you don't know why a jury have come to the verdict that they have done, you know. So,
I suppose it's allowing us... is to see
yes,
how...
except...
Right. Okay. So, up to there, it's two different juries, and it's to see that how one jury of 12 people hear the exact same thing, and yet two different juries would come to different conclusions, probably.
So I suppose it's sort of like looking at how reliable a jury verdicts and is the trial by jury process, I guess.
Yeah.
Except if that was the reason for it, if it was going to be an experiment as such, then they should have made it so that the jury behaved in the exact same, in terms of when they're allowed to talk to each other, you know, like basically at the end. But apparently in this, the jury kept being sort of sent away to a room and they were allowed to discuss the case partway through. And that allowed certain jurors to influence other ones, you know, because like the issue there is that someone might have a very specific view of the case,
email or something. I heard a little bit of a.
I did get an email that cropped up.
I could tell.
So it wasn't as accurate as an experiment as it could have been.
Okay.
So you know, I saw quite a bit of criticism saying that, well, this is just entertainment. You know, like if they wanted to actually. You know, we can't draw any firm conclusions from it because they've not actually replicated what would happen in a case.
Yeah, but I think the roof's leaking on them and there's the toilets are broken. It'd be like an 18-week program. Nothing would happen at the end of it.
Yeah, it keeps getting adjourned because, you know, the judge is ill, and then the next trial gap is actually next November. Sorry, yeah.
What an amusing bit of comedy there for legal people. And
yeah, exactly. But, so some of the criticism's been that, but then I think that some of the counter-criticism to the original criticism is that you've missed the point of this. The point is to show how everyone has inherent biases and they shape our interpretation of the same facts, and that's part of the issue. So you could argue, though, that, you know, basically a jury is meant to be a cross-section of society. So as long as you've got lots of competing different biases, you might get to the right decision. You know, they might balance each other out is one way of looking at it, potentially. Like I say, I've not seen it, so I can't comment on how it actually panned out in the actual program itself. But that's what it is.
It sounds a very interesting experiment.
I think I might watch it if, you know, as and when I've got time. It's a little bit like watching Work, you know what I mean? In the same way that, yes, like nowadays, like, I've not really watched much stand up comedy in the last sort of 10 years, you know, either, for example, other than gigs I've been at. But,
it's like you watch Live at Apollo and go, what was on with them last week in Leeds?
Yes.
And you're like, and then you see the set and you go, oh, that's not how that joke goes. They've had to change that. And then you go, the next bit's better than that bit, but they've cut that bit out because it might be challenging to some of the half-wits that watch telly.
So this sort of thing is probably going to be interesting, but it's like when I've got a spare minute, I might watch it when it's not like just being at work again, you know.
It'd be interesting if they had different defendants. If they had like a really attractive man or woman accused of it, who's like all sort of like a 9 or 10 out of 10, and then they did the same thing with like a really shifty looking person, and exact same facts, somewhat, exact same words, and it's like, oh, he gets sent down. The scruffy bloke gets sent down, and like the handsome man, better community service for him. There's loads.
Someone with like a cocktail stick in the mouth or whatever, chewing one of them. He's up to no good.
A black and white or an suit eye patch. And a violin case under his arm. Hey, what a big idea. I told you not to wear that suit.
with a deck of cards and making them sort of like flicking them from one hand to the other.
No, it could be.
Someone checking his pocket watch. Yeah.
So it does sound good. I started watching Big Brother last night because it was on. And we were...
Oh, is that still a thing?
Oh, I didn't know it was still a thing. But it was...
I think one of the things said that this was a bit like Big Brother, in a way.
Right, like, yes, that's what it sounds like. When they do these sort of experimenty programmes, they normally, from some Dutch psychologist, they often originate in Holland, these kind of programmes. Big Brother, I think, did. And then there was another one where they had prisoners, and that was a Dutch experiment. So, anyway... So we've got these two possible jury outcomes, and so this sounds almost like government propaganda to say, let's abolish the jury system, doesn't it? And so far. So hopefully this works and people will go, well, this is good. The right decision was reached in both cases.
Yes, exactly.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
So the specific question was to do with loss of control. So I'm guessing in the jury's case. Are you thinking of doing one on Channel 4's The Jury? I'd like to know what the psychiatric, psychological basis is. Well, you can't give that, can you? But you can give the legal basis for the loss of control defence. So what is it then? Oh, you've got another email.
So it's basically, I'm just going to mute this. So I think that what's happened in this case, because it is based on a real case, and I think that someone, because Channel 4 didn't reveal what the real case was, but I've seen on social media lots of people saying it's this case.
Right.
You know, I found a case where the facts are almost identical to it, and it must be this one.
Right. So there's a murder.
Basically, so there's been a murder, and then the partial defence of loss of control has been pleaded by the defendant.
Yes.
And that has been the sort of, you know, and then ultimately once that, if that is successfully pleaded, then because it's a partial defence, it basically drops down to manslaughter rather than it's not an acquittal. Like, so like self-defense, for example, would be a complete acquittal.
Yes.
Whereas partial defense.
Control? Yeah. It's the one of the things that comes up in dramas all the time, isn't it? Where or yeah. used to come up in TV dramas. So you get home from work, you find your wife in bed with your best friend, you lose it, and then you just pick up something near to hand and you hit them both and you accidentally kill your wife or you kill your best friend or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing afterwards, you're mortified and go, wasn't me. I was acting. I don't know what happened.
I'd lost control of of my actions and I wasn't thinking about them and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much what it is. It used to be called provocation in the old days, but it was changed to the defense of loss of control. It's only a defense to murder, so you can't, lose control and then rob a bank, So it can only be but it's now called loss of control, and it's found in Section 54 of the Coroners and Justice Act of 2009,
right?
Which actually came into force on the 4th of October 2010. So it's only been, it's only been a defense in this, new iteration since 2010.
Wow, I've never even heard of that act. Never heard of it.
Yeah. So the Coroners and Justice Act is one of these sort of like quite wide-ranging acts that, amends different things here and there, basically. Yeah. I'll just read out what Section 54 says, and then we'll go on to talk about it. Because actually the point you've raised there about coming home and finding your wife in bed with your best friend, that's something we will have to sort of consider because as to whether or not that is a relevant set of circumstances where you can rely on a loss of control as a partial defence.
Yeah, okay.
It's
all a blur to me, but there was like temporary insanity, wasn't there? That was what it used to be, maybe. In
well, that's common. Sort of diminished responsibility, isn't it? Almost, is what you're talking about there to some degree.
Yeah, I can't remember, but it's all very interesting. These are like the juicy bits, aren't they? These are the best bits.
Yeah. Yeah, so loss of control sort of sits alongside diminished responsibility in a way, because that is also a partial defence. But that, within diminished responsibility, you need to have a recognised medical condition which made it so that you weren't able to fully form consider your actions in essence.
Yes.
But loss of control is different to that. There's not that sort of medical side to it. But we'll go through it. So Section 54, right, of the Act says that where a person, D, kills or is a party to the killing of another, V, D is not to be convicted of murder if A, D's acts and omissions in doing or being a party to the killing resulted from D's loss of self-control. So that's the starting point, is that you need to have a loss of control, has to be there.
Yeah.
It's not that... when we look at the rest of the test in a moment, you can't just be someone who's involved in a certain set of circumstances that might be, particularly sort of compelling, as in like, oh my God, this is awful what this person's had to endure, or I could see how someone might be negatively affected by these circumstances. If you don't actually lose control, the defence isn't available to you. You've got to actually lose self-control.
Yeah.
Okay. And you've got to not be in control of your actions. So... it's got to be there. It doesn't have to be a sudden loss of control. So what's interesting there is that under the old defence of provocation, the loss of control had to be sudden. But it doesn't have to be sudden here, but it nevertheless has to be present. You know what I mean? If that makes sense. And we'll talk about what the implication of that change means and why they removed this proviso, this qualification that it had to be a sudden loss of control when they drafted the 2009 Act in a minute. So it's got to be a loss of control, self-control. B, the loss of self-control had a qualifying trigger. And C, a person of D sex and age with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint and in the circumstances of D might have reacted in the same or in a similar way to D.
There's so many little concepts already within this that are very interesting and come up all the time. So we've got a reasonable man test by the
exactly.
of that. Then we've also got a trigger that needs to be present, and then we've got the fact it needs to be a momentary. It can't be something that's been building up over months. of like...
Well, it could potentially be something that's building up over months, because it doesn't have to be sudden, the loss of control.
Oh, did he say it doesn't have to? Sorry, I thought he said does have to be
sudden. No, it doesn't have to be. Oh, it used to have to be under provocation. It had to be sudden.
Right, yes,
it did. But it doesn't have to be under...
Right,
under,
that makes more sense, because
loss of control.
So imagine how people over months of just like minute behaviour, for instance, just things like parking spots with your neighbours, and then suddenly they just blow up and go mental. You see it on telly all the time, and they're just like smashing somebody's car. And
we'll look at, well, obviously, but that yeah, but I mean, that wouldn't be, you couldn't use this then though, because unless you go on and murder them parking spot then. Yeah, I think a more pertinent one would be, you know, someone who's subject in an abusive relationship. You know what I mean? That is like months or years of controlling and coercive behaviour, or you know, that sort of constant drip, drip, drip in the background of that type of activity. Now, those people, you know, for want of a better term, what used to be called battered wives sort of syndrome was an issue there. You know, often that defense of provocation wasn't available to those people, because their loss of control hadn't been sudden. You know what I mean? It had been as a result of months or years of a slow burn type scenario. But we'll look at that in a bit more detail as well, because actually there might be issues for them relying on this as well, to be honest with you. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So there's loads in there. So you've identified, like the good former law student that you were, that you are, that there is an objective test in this, the reasonable man and all that sort of carry on. There's also, it's basically a three-part test, isn't it? It's that they've lost self-control. That's a subjective element. You know, did this individual lose control of their actions?
Yes.
There's also that the loss of control had a qualifying trigger. We'll look at those in a minute. That's also subjective. And then you've got an objective test of, like, would someone of their sex and age with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint have reacted in the same or in a similar way to them? Yes. Okay. So let me quickly look at, so qualifying trigger, that takes us to section 55, which tells us what a qualifying trigger is. So there are two potential qualifying triggers. One is the fear of serious violence from V against D or another identified person. So fear of serious violence is there, and or things done or said which constituted circumstances of an extremely grave character and caused D to have a justifiable sense of being seriously wronged. Okay, so it doesn't have to just be a fear of serious violence. You can have this justifiable sense of being seriously wronged by things of an extremely grave character. Okay. So there's two different ones there, and they are. You know, that's a subjective element. Did either of these apply? Maybe both applied. You know, in the case of like an abusive relationship, you know, you could probably conceivably argue that I feared serious violence because of what's gone on previously, and also I've got, you know, I've got a justifiable sense of being seriously wronged because of, you know, the fact that I'm in this because of how he's treated me. You know, so there's potentially both at play. But that's the qualifying trigger, okay? Yeah. I want to talk about one or two other sort of more sort of like housekeeping issues, okay? Right? So,
I've just found something. This might just be a little helpful.
So
the jury. This is what happens in the TV trial. Just for anyone that's seen it, the crime involves a sculptor, John, a man with no history of violence, who killed his wife, Helen, first by strangling her and then smashing the sides of her head with an industrial hammer. Is he guilty of murder or manslaughter, pleading loss of control? Right.
Yeah.
So that's essentially, those are the facts.
And I think that there must have been some sort of, so for him to rely on loss of control, there has to be some sort of qualifying trigger, which I think in this case, having looked at what I think the real case that this was based on was something to do with the fact that they were basically in an unhappy relationship.
Yeah.
And there was an argument about decorating of the house, and also that she had been unfaithful to him as well.
Okay.
And various sort of competing and or interrelated issues, basically. And that the trigger was this argument about decorating of the house or something or other. Things that all... Each, you know, on their own are probably large, you know, seem quite mundane, but maybe you know, that it was presented in such a way that the jury sort of found that, yeah, we think actually he did lose control sufficient to the, you know, because yeah. he, you know, for whatever reason.
Helen's a troubled, volatile individual with severe mental health issues.
Right, okay.
As well, which might have exacerbated something. So,
yeah.
That was just, that's the best, like, thing I can put. So we know some of the facts in the case. Right. So
for loss of control, then, is that once it's pleaded, so once the defense pleads it, this is, you know, so then
is it the case of there's no going back after that? So if it's found there's no loss of control, it's automatically then it is murder. It's not something you can then like
withdraw. So basically the burden of proof. So if you say, right, you're charged with murder, you say, well, I lost control because of these circumstances.
Yeah.
All you have to do as the defense is to basically raise an issue with respect to the defense if evidence is adduced on which, in the opinion of the trial judge, a jury properly directed could reasonably conclude that the defense might apply.
Yeah.
So it's about there's no burden on you to prove the defense. All you need to prove is that, as the defendant who's trying to rely on this, is that it's at least arguable that it might be applicable. You know, that you've got a prima facie case, okay? Which is similar to other defenses, like, you know, self-defense is the same. You raise the issue of self-defense. The judge says, yeah, there's sufficient there to, you know, the evidential burden is on you to sort of show that, you know, this isn't completely without any sort of basis at all. And then it's for the prosecution to prove that the defence doesn't apply to the criminal, and that's to the criminal standard. So what subsection 5 of the Act says is that on a charge of murder, if sufficient evidence is adduced to raise an issue with respect to the defence under subsection 1, i.e. loss of control, the jury must assume that the defence is satisfied unless the prosecution proves beyond reasonable doubt that it is not.
Okay.
So the prosecution have to disprove it to the criminal standard, you know. So,
right.
You know, but in reality, there's going to be, you know, the defence is going to have to raise some evidence to otherwise you're giving the prosecution a bit of an open goal to sort of prove it's not there by pointing out the fact that you've not introduced any evidence to support your assertion that you lost control. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
You know, there's that, what you might call a tactical burden there on the defence. So that's the defence as it is. Now, you mentioned before, so what sort of things have been qualifying triggers?
Yeah.
You mentioned you instantly went for the sort of like sexual infidelity.
Something that you've seen. I've seen it 100 times on TV programmes, and I just assumed, because it's just the most juicy, it's just a very juicy topic, isn't it, if you're doing a drama on TV. Feels like I've seen it 100 times. I don't know why that was my go-to one, but maybe years ago, maybe it was the one that you always talked about. It was always given as the example in an exam that such a buddy comes home and finds their husband, or they find the wife in bed with a such a buddy. Yeah, so that's why I said that. So, but this one, it seems, isn't that? This is something more to do with decorating, which actually, in my current life, I can see being the thing to actually tip anyone over the edge.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think that there was some sort of issue of sexual infidelity there as well with them in this case. What's interesting, though, is that under section 55, which is the meaning of a qualifying trigger, that's how the Act is laid out. You know, it tells you in section 54, you need to have this qualifying trigger. Section 55 says, well, this is what a qualifying trigger is. Under subsection 6 of that, it qualifies what can and can't be done. So, for example, under subsection 6A, it says that D's fear of serious violence is to be disregarded to the extent that it was caused by a thing which D incited to be done or said for the purpose of providing an excuse to use violence. So you can't bring it on yourself and then claim that you lost control. You know, so you can't start a fight and then say, well, I lost control in the fight, you know what I mean? And therefore I shouldn't be convicted of murder. Similarly, under subsection B, you can't use the sense of being seriously wronged by things said or done If, again, you've incited the thing to be said or done for the purpose of providing an excuse to use violence.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So again, you can't wind someone up, let them say something in return to you and then go, ha ha, there's my qualifying trigger. I'm going to batter this person to death. No, you can't do that. You know, that's 'cause that's effectively what that's making out, yeah. Scenarios like that. And C, more crucially for our case, the fact that a thing done or said constituted sexual infidelity is to be disregarded.
Right. Okay.
So, because what I mean, if you think about what the risk might be there, if sexual infidelity was allowed to be the qualifying trigger, what do you think that might do?
I don't know. Well, you could, if you wanted to murder someone, you could secretly manufacture that someone else slept with them, so you'd just be able to murder them, and you'd have a defence. Is that what you mean?
Well, it sort of gives carte blanche on it to people to, you know, it's almost like them asserting ownership of someone over right. someone. You know, like basically you are allowed to kill someone. You know, you're allowed to literally get away with the murder of somebody because they were sexually unfaithful to you. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's a dangerous thing to allow, isn't it?
I'm sure this used to be a defence. I'm sure that with this
provocation was wider in its definition as to what the thing could be, and yeah. that would allow that. So that could be put to the jury, and the jury could decide in those circumstances whether or not it was reasonable.
That's an interesting sort of change. Maybe it's more yeah. to do with society. Maybe it's to do with marriage not being as big a part. Maybe religion as well, because infidelity is a huge thing that you're not allowed to do in religion. It's a huge thing you're not allowed to do in marriage. And now,
yeah,
I mean, I don't agree with that it should have been in the past. But, I was always convinced that this used to be, that this was like the classic scenario of provocation. Somebody comes yeah. home, they find yeah. the husband in bed, find the wife in bed with somebody else. They pick something up to hand, they smash it over someone's head, that person dies, they go, I didn't mean it, I was in a rage, I don't even remember doing it, and it used to get, I'm sure that was the provocation. Sure it was.
Yeah, well, it probably would have been under the old law of provocation, yeah, but yeah. it can't apply now under loss of control because they've narrowed that definition by putting that in there. There is, however, a case. So what that's led to, though, is like you have to disregard, having to disregard the infidelity element of it, is that you can get some really weird situations potentially where, you know, to give you an example, let's say that V, like in the middle of an argument, V confesses to adultery to D, okay?
Yeah.
So she admits, so your wife admits she's been having an affair, and then taunts the husband, though, by saying that she had to find someone else to satisfy her as he was rubbish in bed and he's now impotent and blah, blah, blah. You know, like, and she goes further than that. And
she's got like a PowerPoint that she puts on. This is what you don't do.
Yeah. So if he then responds to that and loses control and kills her, right?
Yeah.
Then in deciding whether or not there's a qualifying trigger, you would have to, if you were taking the law at its literal, you know, in its literal sense, you would have to direct the jury that they were to disregard the reference to her having been unfaithful, but could consider whether or not saying he was impotent and that, you know, like,
wow.
and that she had to find another lover, that could be considered. And that's a really sort of false situation to be in, if you think about it. You know, like that's because that's not real, because clearly none of those other things that have been said by her to him would be said by her to him if the issue of infidelity hadn't been there. So it's like asking you to look at them in a vacuum and asking you to think about his reaction, you know, like those, for example, those words, those taunts are probably more powerful coming from her after she's just admitted to having an affair.
Yes, of course. And also the reasonable man test to come. If you do, what would a reasonable person in that situation
do? Might they do in that situation?
Is it reasonable that you'd lose control if taunted with this, that, and the other? Yes. It kind of is.
It depends on what you think is the jury, and this is the thing. So the court actually did sort of rectify this situation in the case of Clinton, where they said that the prohibition on having regard to sexual infidelity only applies where that is the only qualifying trigger, potentially.
Right.
So if the only thing is that, look, I've been having an affair, say your wife says that to you, then you lose control and beat her to death. you can't then rely on that. You know, you can't rely on the defence. If, however, it's one of a number of different scenarios, like in the example I just gave, then you can consider the sexual infidelity, because it's clearly relevant to assessing whether or not he did lose control and whether or not a reasonable person might have lost control in those circumstances. So, you know, it gets some criticism in the case of Clinton, but I think it does sort of make sense from a logical point of view.
Yeah.
Albeit it is expressly going against the words of the statute, though, you know, so...
Yeah.
It's an interesting case. But I sort of think I can see why they would do that, because otherwise you find yourself in these potentially false sort of scenarios of having to disregard a really, really obviously important linking piece of information that puts the other things into context, you know. But I can also see why they want to say that you can't rely on sexual infidelity to be an excuse or a qualifying trigger. I can also see both. So, but I think Clinton maybe strikes the balance about right, maybe.
Yes.
You know.
Oh, that's interesting. That's good. That's another, like, the law working as it should. Example, isn't
it? Yeah. So, like, you know, the Parliament passes laws and the court interprets them, you know, and that's what's happened there, isn't it? So, so that's, you know, that's how it works. Interestingly, so moving on to then the objective test, I think the question by John was about the sort of psychology and psychiatric element of loss of control. And as you can see from the test, there is no reference to any sort of like having to have been suffered from a psychiatric condition or to be, you know, you're not actually insane, you've lost control, and that's a different thing. You know, diminished responsibility is where there is sort of medical evidence involved in it. You know, that's a different defence, albeit it has the same net effect in a way, because, you know, you are still convicted of manslaughter, albeit it might be that under diminished responsibility, there's possibly some hospital orders that might be made as well or something like that. Whereas in this case, it's just you've lost control. You know, you are a reasonable person, and you know the test tells you like to what would a reasonable person do, and there is case law on this point in terms of like a mental disorder. So the case of Rejmansky, okay, from 2017, the question of the extent to which a mental disorder, which I think in this case was post-traumatic stress disorder, there were two conjoined appeals. There was a PTSD one and another one that was personality disorder. Are they relevant to the assessment of the circumstances of the defendant? So that does that count as one of the circumstances of the defendant that needs to be taken into consideration? Because if someone has a mental disorder, then maybe they, you know, they don't, you're sort of judging them against other people with PTSD as opposed to against the reasonable person, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does, But the reasonable man test can't apply because they're not a reasonable themselves.
Yeah,
they're not in
exactly. And that's exactly what the Court of Appeal found. So well done. You're on the same line as them. So the Court of Appeal sort of basically found that the objective test in section 54(1)(c) is clear. You know, like it's really clearly worded, and it can't be watered down to allow mental disorders to be taken into account by the jury when judging against the standard of a person with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint. You know what I mean? The wording of it is really clear, and therefore it's not relevant. So in a way, the psychiatrics and all that are something that would potentially go against, you know, they're not something that's not relevant, basically. So so it's an interesting scenario there.
So let's give this scenario then of, say, we've got the jury program, and we don't fully know what the case was, but the man murdered his wife, Helen. I think he's called John. Murdered his wife, Helen. Say he'd had a history of mental illness. He could not rely on this defense because he would fall down on hurdle 3, passing the reasonable man test. So he would not be able to rely on this defense. He'd have to go for a different defense to do with his own psychological
He could potentially rely on it, but what he couldn't do is say that you need to take particular consideration to my to my psychological disorder. And that's because, you know, it's about basically someone not being able to say, you need to give me a bit more leeway here because my PTSD was triggered and that's why I did what I did. You know what I mean? Because you still, you're assessing it against the reasonable person and the reasonable, you know, like the everyday person doesn't have PTSD. It's a disorder, you know, that someone's been diagnosed with, you know, that's away from the normal, you know. So I was trying to put that as diplomatically as I could, but you know what I mean? Like, that's the difference there. So he could still potentially rely on self-control if, regardless, you know, like taking out this. So basically the jury aren't allowed to consider the PTSD as one of his circumstances in relation to assessing whether a reasonable person would have reacted in the same way with the same self-restraint and tolerance. So he could still rely on it, but it may well be that if actually what he did was entirely because of his PTSD and a reasonable person wouldn't have reacted in the same way, you know, like wouldn't have been triggered in the same way that he was or whatever, at that point it may be that diminished responsibility is a more relevant defence to rely on.
Right, I see.
If that's the argument that needs to be made. You know, there are some circumstances where medical evidence might go into this defence, but by and large, it's been proven that because the wording of the act is so clear that, you know, this is a reasonable person with normal levels of restraint and self-restraint and tolerance, that, you know, you can't then start backsliding on that and saying, well, let's make it a reasonable person with the same medical conditions as this person here. And the court have been clear as to that they won't allow for that. Which brings us on, right, okay, to the issue of people that are, you know, the subject of abuse within a relationship.
Right.
Because there's been a number of cases about that previously. And part of the argument has been that the new act of loss of self-control, because it doesn't have to be sudden, is actually better for people that are subject to like coercive control and long-term abuse, because it allows for this sort of slow burn of a loss of control to apply. But there is still an issue there, though, if you think about it, because I'm not convinced that it does. I think they'll still struggle to rely on loss of control, mainly because of the starting point is that you have to lose control. And so depending on the nature of your sort of act, quite often, like an abused woman who killed, like there was a case where the woman, after years of like horrific abuse on the part of her husband,
I remember this, a year or two ago,
basically set fire to him. You know what I mean? Yeah. I know this is from 1992.
Oh, right.
This particular case, this is under the old rule of provocation. And she, you know, one night poured petrol on him and set fire to him in bed, and he died of the injuries. And she effectively had to rely on diminished responsibility, potentially. And so the issue there was whether or not battered wife syndrome was a medical condition that could be relied on for diminished responsibility. You know, like that was the argument there. Because her loss of control hadn't been sudden, you know, it wasn't a response to something like that. So you had a bit of a scenario in the past where, because of the sudden nature of a loss of control, is it sort of maybe allowed a man to kill his wife in anger, you know, because of her cheating on him, potentially, whereas it didn't allow a wife to kill a husband in response to years of abuse. You know what I mean? Yes. So it was sort of stacked in the favour of abusive men, you know, and against unfaithful women, you know, and was probably reflective of that sort of idea of marriage as ownership, you know, and so on, that there was a bit of an archaic view. And so it has moved us away from that, but I still think that there would be an issue in proving that someone had lost control if they have acted, you know, almost sort of calmly and are basically taking revenge for years of abuse. You know, there's a potential there for them to struggle to be able to rely on it. But the courts do recognise control and coercive behaviour as an issue now. So maybe we will get a case that categorically says that you can rely on it in due course. But the case law at the minute is a bit unclear as to whether or not you can. And I think that you would struggle because, again, I think you would be looking at the nature of the act that it is. And it's about whether or not a jury would be willing to accept that you'd lost control in those circumstances. And I'm not sure that they would do, because as based on my reading of the reaction to this Channel 4 show, is that, you know, apparently there's enough people on a jury that would not go along with, that would not side with it with a battered wife, basically, seems to be what people are saying. And everyone has their biases, and that might mean that that you would struggle to convince enough of the jury to that you had lost control in these circumstances. So yeah, it's an interesting one, and I still think that maybe diminished responsibility would be the way to go. But again, that has its issues as well. So you've got an issue here where you've got someone potentially, you know, who can't rely on loss of self-control, who doesn't have a sort of like recognized sort of like abnormality of mental functioning that medicalizes the experience. And it's sort of, I don't know, it just seems a bit not necessarily unfair, but unpalatable, I think, or unsatisfactory of a position for the law to be in, that in order for someone who is effectively the victim of abuse and reacts to that, if they do that in the wrong way or in a way that doesn't fit the criteria of loss of self-control, they have to be medicalized as having some sort of mental abnormality. You know, that just seems a bit unreasonable to me.
I'm sure this was a similar problem to the Crown and Quick, an episode we did 10 episodes back, maybe, where it's the fella in his junk room, he's also insulin dependent or diabetic, and he's got the choice of the stigma of insanity, not insanity. And if he pleads insanity, it would affect his future work position. And that's a case from the 70s. That's 50 years ago now. And it feels like here we're in a similar sort of area where it's the law's not quite where you would like it to be. Or maybe the statute's not quite where you'd like it to be. But
Well, if you think about it, it's about how you interpret loss of control, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's how's that going to be defined and how's that going to be interpreted? Because it doesn't say sudden. So the door is open, potentially, for someone to show, I lost control and I did what I did. But it's getting a jury to accept that, you know, if you methodically, for example, in the case of the woman who set fire to her husband in bed, that would be difficult for her to show on a factual basis that she was acting due to a loss of control without there being some sort of, medicalized issue underneath. Yeah.
Unless petrol's usually kept in the bedroom in that household and there's also rags because near it and matches. Then the whole separation of, just go to the garage. Oof, petrol's £1.50 a blinking litre. That's a lot, isn't it? I've not got the right container. I'll have to go back. And then you do that. Then you have to go in and pay on your card. Then you also need some sort of rag. I suppose you could just tip the petrol on them. The blankets would act like that. And then you've got to throw them
out.
So that's too remote. That, I think from Matt,
It's the remoteness from the trigger, isn't it? That's the issue.
And it used to be the case, pick up a plant pot, it's heavy, you throw the plant pot on them, it was the first thing that was to hand, you didn't have to run into another room. Even running into another room used to be enough, almost, to go, hang on, this wasn't an immediate loss of control. You had to leave the room, find a knife, run back upstairs, and then, you know what I mean? That was like that degree of separation that used to be the case.
I think you still have that issue, don't you, really? Because you've got to talk about, you know, has this person actually lost control of what they're doing? And the more remote that action is from what is basically the qualifying trigger, then the more difficult it is to convince a jury that that's what's happened, and the easier it is for the prosecution to show that this wasn't done, this was someone who was acting very much, you know, and you would term it, you put it in the, you know, you put it in these terms, you would say, you know, this person was the victim of years of abuse. It's almost understand, you can see why she might have wanted to do this, and, you know, but she nevertheless shouldn't have done it, but she didn't lose control because she was acting very much in a calculating manner to take revenge, you know, like in response to these things, but she hadn't lost control. And it's that ability to show that you've lost control that is the difficulty here. So I wonder whether the removal of the word sudden from the test doesn't really make that much difference, because you've still got to show that you were triggered into this action. And that's got to be sort of almost fairly sort of sudden to convince a jury that that's what's happened. I don't know. Maybe there will be a case that's suitably well argued by a lawyer better than me to show that there was a loss of control here, and that becomes the precedent for these things. Because that, like I said, the door's open there. They're looking at the wording of the test, but it's difficult to see at the present time how that could pan out, I think.
Well, this is clearly why they've chosen this kind of case to try and illustrate. I think part of the reasoning for the programme, the jury, is that it's based on the idea that 25% of the time juries arrive at the wrong decision. So
yeah,
they need to find a specific a case that's complicated, that's also got enough of like grey areas and is modern enough that you can't argue this. Oh, there's case law with these exact facts or these very, very similar facts. So you're arguing in all these grey areas, and then you've got two lots of juries who are not even actually treated like a jury. So we don't know exactly how the judge at the end of the case... Well, firstly, they're allowed to deliberate throughout the case, which wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Then who knows what the direction from the judge was on all the legal points. So it's probably not as...
It's not scientific, is it?
No,
yeah.
Because from a TV point of view, I worked in TV for many years, before like the whole Ant and Dec scandal. Do you remember when there was like, so it was going back 15, 16 years ago, and there was like a live TV quiz thing that Ant and Dec did, probably on Saturday night, and it turned out that there was a potentially three winners or something like that, and they chose...
Oh, yeah, those phoning things, yeah.
So they had to then... And it was all to do with reaction. Now, when I was on the radio, for years, you'd get the people and say, right, you might be the winner, you might be the winner, you might be the winner, and then you'd pick out of the best three or four or five that had phoned up and go, this girl, she's 20, she's really a lot of fun, she's got, like, she's got a bad... history of like she's just had a baby and her boyfriend's just left her, and if she wins this car it'll change her life, she's gonna react, but she's a nurse, do you know what I mean, all these ticks,
if you're which listener, is gonna be the best telly basically.
So that's exactly what they'll still do in something like this, because they can't do it quite anymore where they manufacture a winner, of like this is the big do you know when they do those house programs, I'm always astounded. So they'll have this the perfect person, and Alan Titchmarsh will go round and do the garden, and the wife's husband's died, and it's been a horrible thing, and she's had problems, and she's losing mobility and all that, and then they do like £100,000 worth of a garden for her to change her life, and the woman just sort of comes in and says, oh yeah, this is really lovely, thanks very much, and you see like the disappointment, because the whole program is built up. To go, this is the best thing in the world. Oh my God, I'm breaking down crying. Oh, look, here's all my kids around. We're all crying. You've made our lives perfect. But they never quite get the reaction in those house programs.
Hold
it together and go, oh yeah, very good. Oh, thanks. You've saved me a lot of hassle with 30 grand. it's that. Whereas in this sort of scenario, they can manufacture situations that are not true to life.
I'm going to say that.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah, go on.
Purely by saying, if in a real trial, if a jury's not allowed to deliberate until they've heard all the evidence, they've also been directed by the judge, if you're not doing it to that, then... It's false.
You can't draw any firm conclusions.
It's a false experiment.
And it's telly is what it is. It's entertainment rather than an experiment.
And the reason they don't do this... Well, they're actors as well playing it. So you've got that one sense of removal from...
Are they actors? I think they're members of the public, aren't they?
No,
you mean actors in the courtroom, you mean? All right,
so it's not a person who's going, why did you murder your wife? And then he goes, oh, look.
Yeah, it's not someone who's actually on trial for murder, is it? Yeah, exactly.
It's someone who's going, right, in this sentence, I am going to be... remorseful. In this sentence, I'm going to have a hint of anger and a dark past in it. So, you know, so they're not drawing a proper conclusion because you're drawing it from an actor.
And the jurors know that it's not real.
Yes.
So, so there's not the same thing. They know they're on telly, so they're playing up, probably. Yeah. It's like all of the things, you know, like that are wrong with,
you know, it's the opposite of like blind testing, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like people are being observed, know they're being observed, and therefore will behave differently. Like all animals do that.
Yes, you know, of course.
You've also got juries made up of the type of people that want to be on telly in that kind of scenario as well. You know, so it's, yeah, I wouldn't draw too many, you know, I wouldn't use this program as the final nail in the coffin of the jury system, to be honest with you, because it's not true to life, you know.
No, unless like three members of that jury absolutely do not want to be there because they're self-employed and they're not going to get paid and they might lose a client and they want it over with as quickly as possible, and then someone else is a lonely old person who this is the first time they spoke to anybody, and suddenly they're being told how important they are in deciding someone's freedom. They want it to go on as long as possible. Till you've got all those other things in play, it's nonsense. So
yeah, exactly.
But anyway, it was a bit of fun, wasn't it? I wonder what I might watch this the jury now, or the trial. I think it's called the jury, isn't it? I think I'll try and find it on Channel 4's Catch Up, and I'm interested to see what the two verdicts are.
Yeah.
But even then, there is no stake. So it's ultimately a pointless programme as well. And also your point going in, the whole point of doing it is to prove that 25% of the time juries are wrong. So the whole programme centres around, will the jury come to the right decision? So it's pointless. Because there is no right decision.
Exactly. It's like the, you know, you hear the evidence and you hope that you get to the truth, but you don't necessarily know that, you know. So it's interesting, but I think it's entertainment rather than in any way a scientific look at how juries operate. Say for that, the one point is that everybody has biases, and if it is a genuine representation of society, then you're going to have lots of competing biases, and as I said at the start, maybe they cancel each other out and you still get to the right decision anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
It depends. I don't know.
75% of the time. That's
exactly. Yeah.
So, do you know what would be interesting is if they then tried it using other less adversarial systems, for instance, use the French model, and then go, right, here's
all
like
that's an investigative procedure. Yes.
And so rather than stuff being allowed or disallowed under rules of evidence, things like hearsay, or, you know, in a French system, that is like that's given some weight. Where
right, okay, so you can advise as to the weight to be attached to it.
I think it's
so
more like the
civil system, basically.
I think it's the French system's less adversarial, and it's not like East versus West, Red versus Blue. I think it's like, let's take in all the evidence here, and let's all try and find what we think the actual result is. Anyway, I don't know why I'm saying that. I don't know what the fuck I'm on about.
No, I think it's an interesting point. I think it would be like to try a different thing, but you'd have to use the same jury, wouldn't you?
By the second time round, they'd be bored. And they'd also have read the reviews and go, oh, people didn't like it when I was a bit misogynistic. So then that same person comes in and going, hey, I think it's wrong to murder anybody, even if she was trying to murder him.
I think it's wrong to murder anyone, even strumpet, you know, or whatever. You know, so.
Oh, God. It'd be funny to have done this in the... You remember that 7-Up television experiment programme? That was quite a good one, where it was like, the 50s, I think. Here's a kid that's 7, and then here's a kid that's 14. Here's the same kid at 21. I think they stopped doing it. I think they tried to do it a few years ago. And I think most people just went, I don't want to be in this program anymore. Kind of ruins my life for a year whenever I'm on it. But some of them did well and some of them did badly. It'd be interesting to do it the exact same facts every 7 years. If they'd have started this in the 50s or 60s, to see how attitudes had changed, how the law had changed, how suddenly the, you know, having an affair, your wife having an affair was no longer an excuse to murder her, and to see where we end up in 7 years and 14 years, that might be interesting. But I don't know if it would, because I've not watched this one and I probably won't. So.
No, exactly. But it would be interesting though to see how see how attitudes change and which attitudes remain. I'd be more interested to see that, you know, which ones actually persist, you know, which biases are always there, regardless of how society changes and education and all that sort of stuff.
So, final question. When in American TV, so for instance, there's a program called The Bull, B-U-L-L, and he's a psychological expert on the way people will on a jury. He can tell just by saying, what university did you go to, what brand of cereal do you like. So they'll ask three questions to a juror, and then he'll go, this person's borderline racist and they'll definitely convict, so strike them. So each side is allowed to get rid of three members of the jury that they don't like, that they don't want on the jury, and then there's a reserve one, and judges can strike people off if they've proven to be, say, racist or whatever. So when a jury trial, do they have the same thing in the UK? So in England, sorry, where England and Wales, where the both sets of counsel have got the jury in front of them, they get to interview the jury, they get to say, I want this person disqualified off this jury, I want this other juror brought in. Does that happen?
So, this could be like an episode in itself because it's quite a long thing. So, ordinarily, a jury is selected at random from the people that are on jury duty that week or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
On that particular day. So, they're selected at random. So the general principles are that they're selected at random from a panel, but there is a right of sort of challenge to that potentially. Right.
Why don't we? Let's stop it there, because this sounds like a full episode on its own. Because we're 56 minutes in and we're on a massively different topic. So let's do this.
Let's do this next time.
This next time. And we also need to do Greg's. And I'm going away, so maybe we can record another one and release it in a couple of weeks. We can record another one.
We can record one before you go away.
Because otherwise I'm away for a long time now. So... right, let's do that. So thank you, John, for sending us that question. Anybody wants to send us a question, we're on Twitter at Barely Legal Comedy Pod, I think we're called. Barely Legal Comedy Podcast on Instagram. Barely Legal Comedy Podcast at gmail.com. Those are the ways to get in touch with us. So please do. And thank you very much, Keo. Let's do juries next then. Let's carry on from this. Great topic, John.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yes. See you, everybody.
Yeah, bye.